This Father's Day at Lowe's, score free gifts for the greatest dad. Right now, get a free select DeWalt, Craftsman, or Kobalt tool with purchase of a select battery kit. Plus, get a free Werner 2-foot aluminum ladder when you buy an 8-foot fiberglass ladder. Shop these deals and more this Father's Day at Lowe's. We help, you save. Valid through 6/15 while supplies last. Selection varies by location.
NBI Studios, this is Truth and Justice, a crowdsourced investigation in real time. I'm Bob Ruff. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Truth and Justice. We are joined once again today by the man who's becoming an extra co-host of the show as many times as we've had him on in the last couple of months. Our good friend from the Defense Diaries, Mr. Bob Mata, is back. There's been more developments on the Delphi case. I thought everything was done. It's not. And you all wanted to have Bob come back on. And of course, I want to know what's going on. So Bob, thanks so much. I know you've been traveling and just came squealing the tires into the driveway in time to come in and do this. So thanks for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure. My pleasure, my friend. Yeah, had a little, I had a busy week of traveling. I had, unfortunately, some sad news on the family side. I had an uncle pass away just 2 days ago, actually. But I was traveling for another reason. I have a annual Super Bowl trip. Which oddly
Chiefs
enough,
guy or a
I'm
Philly
neither.
Guy.
We have. I've lived in Philly, so I was, and my wife is from Philly, so I was definitely rooting for the Eagles. Plus, much like everybody that lives outside of Kansas City, I was sick of Mahomes and the Chiefs winning. So,
right
from that perspective, I was definitely rooting for the Eagles. But no, we do this thing every year. We've been doing it for like 20 years. A big group of my friends and I, we always get together for a few days around Super Bowl and just man bond, you know, like only men can do in their weirdness.
Right. Yeah. The weirdness was in full effect, I'm sure.
Right. Yeah, definitely. Yeah, you know, like the women do not need to be subjected to the weirdness. So, but it's a great time. We usually have a lot of fun. So yeah, but I just got back from that, man. So I'm ready to talk to Delphi. Let's talk to Delphi, yeah. Bob.
So I had intended on doing a bunch of catching up. I've caught some of your lives, parts of them, and done some reading. And then Bob and I were talking about off the air. My wife and I adopted a rescue yesterday. We brought her home yesterday and put her in the kennel today when we left for work and came back. And either the kennel wasn't latched right or she got out, but she was in a closed room and came home to what looked like a crime scene. The carpet was ripped up, and then she cut her paws on the tack strip of the carpet, and so there was poop and blood and stuff all over Becky's library, which is the worst place in the house for that to have happened in. So it's been a wild afternoon, to put it mildly. So I'm gonna have you
Bob, I hate to laugh because that's really a very, very sad story in a lot of different ways.
Well, the good news is we got to the point before I came out here after 3 hours of cleaning up the mess that the room's back together enough that Becky was laughing a little bit when we left, because she was certainly not laughing earlier.
That's good. It's Kaylin, at some point you have to laugh, and yep. It makes for a good story. You know, it's always horrible shit that happens that makes for a good story down the road. So
she always gets mad at me. Kaylin, the puppy, she's okay. She does her paws are luckily they're just like scratched up a little bit. Actually, Becky's right now running to the veterinary supply store to get some stuff that we can patch up her, because we can't let her out of the pen because she's got bloody feet, so she can blood all over the place. So I did hold her in my lap for a half hour and cuddled with her and let her know that we still love her.
That's good. That's good puppy love, man. You know.
Yeah, she's doing. The puppy's doing better than Becky is. I'll put it that way. And when I was leaving, she was texting one of her friends. She's like, every time I want to be crazy and irrational, stupid Bob comes in and tells me it's just things, Becky. It's everything's fine.
It's just stuff.
And she's like, I don't want your logic and reason right now. I want to be mad.
Furious. want to be serious, which is, it's fair. It's fair. When they're young and they don't know any better, speaking of puppies, my son, who at the time they were living with us, our son was going to medic school. So in his preparation, become a firefighter. And we allowed him and his now wife to get a dog. And we had our guy, and he was, I think, probably 2.5, 3 at the time. And my son's dog, Stella, was a cute little puppy, but she was a wood eater. So, which we obviously didn't know. She was a rescue as well. And so I went out, and we have a long lead that we'll oftentimes hook the dogs up to, just to kind of let them out, because they don't allow fences where we live. And I don't have the invisible fence. So I let her out. She was out there for like 25 minutes. I come back in and she had eaten, like our house is sided with cedar.
Oh, so no.
She had eaten about 4 of the planks, man. It was unbelievable the amount of damage the dog had done. I was, obviously I was furious, but she's just a sweet little puppy, man. You know, what could I do?
You got to keep reminding yourself. I'm so angry. I was like, she doesn't know any better. She was just scared.
She doesn't know. She just loves to eat wood.
Yeah. There's a lot more to this story, but this episode's going to air on Sunday, and we have a follow-up coming on Friday. So all the people listening to this will, I'm sure, have already heard that story, because we'll be talking about and record that tomorrow. So for now, let's get into Delphi. So trial's over. Richard Allen's convicted. He gets sentenced, and then has the direct appeal been filed? Or I know you had his attorneys on your show talking about some of the issues that they had with the trial. Mainly what I would like to focus on today, while I'm still trying to get a good grasp on this case, is the evidence that the judge would not allow to come forward in trial. Specifically, I know I heard that there was a confession from somebody else, supposedly, that was not allowed in. So if you could kind of go through and break down, like, what new evidence, or the people that knew, that watched the trial and got all their information from the trial, which is all of us, through you and other media sources, what evidence have we learned about now that we didn't learn in the trial?
Okay, so, and just so people have a clear understanding, no, the direct appeal has not been filed, and his trial attorneys, that would be Baldwin, Rosie, and Ajay, are not the ones handling the appeal. Now, they'll obviously help the appellate defenders who have been appointed. So he was appointed appellate defenders. He's been appointed 2 of them. And then we know who they are at this point, and they are very well-respected, excellent appellate attorneys. In terms of kind of like who the people that are in the know in the state of Indiana in terms of attorneys were wanting to get appointed, got appointed. So he's got 2 very capable appellate attorneys, which is good. In a case like this where, again, I always talk about the fact that, if you think about all the cases that we cover and have been covering for a long time, it's pretty rare post-conviction to see such a wide split of people of the mindset that they got the wrong person, like early on. Like right after the trial, it's like, you'll get those folks where you have people like us digging into wrongful convictions, and people like, wow, yeah, I'm behind that. You'll have West Memphis 3 or Avery, those exist in the world, but it's way after the fact, and it's way after time is built up, and it's way after people have decided to dig into those cases and they unearth things. This is right after trial, and so it's unusual. So at any rate, in Indiana, it's a little different than they do it in Illinois. In Illinois, we have to file a motion as a prerequisite to filing our notice of appeal. We have to file something called motion for a new trial. Now, in Indiana, they don't have that prerequisite, but it's allowable for the defense to file something called a motion to correct errors. And that was what was filed in this case. And that dropped probably about 2 weeks ago. And it was pretty bombshell information in it. I'll kind of go through each. There were 4 main points of contention, okay? And essentially what you're asking, the trial judge, and this goes in front of the trial judge. This doesn't go in front of the appellate court. It's of record, though, okay? Meaning that when the full record is created for the appellate court, this particular document will be a part of the record. in terms of what they will be looking at. So in that sense, it was an important filing for the defense to get on file, because it does contain information that they think is relevant and will be relevant down the road on the appeal, especially as to the third-party culprit stuff, which, right, if you've been following the case, was disallowed entirely, no matter mm-hmm. whether it was Odinism or Kagan Klein or anybody. She shut mm-hmm. it all down, she being Gull. So there were four kind of main points of contention. The first one was regarding Allen's confinement conditions and how he got to be that way, being that he was held in a prison as opposed to a jail for the entirety of time that he was in custody prior to trial. Of course, as you know, Bob, we all have a presumption of innocence if we're arrested,
right,
until the state proves us guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. So that really kind of dove into that aspect. It turned out we learned that Richard Allen did have an attorney on the 26th of October who had been retained, who had made phone calls to the prosecutor, Nick McClelland, had also made phone calls to the Carroll County Sheriff's Office and talked to people over there saying, hey, you know, like, what are you guys doing with him? Like, where is he? When can we get in to see him? I need to talk to him. And at that point, on the 26th of October, they said, well, he hasn't been formally charged. By the 28th, he's formally charged. And then kind of the behind the curtain, no actual substantive hearing was held. No actual physical hearing was held for the safekeeping, wherein that allowed them to move his custody over the Department of Corrections, which allowed them to put him in a prison for safekeeping mm-hmm. Because of, you know, threats that didn't really exist but were thought to exist, even though nobody could articulate any kind of actual threat. But they're like, oh, well, you know, he's accused of being a child murderer, so they usually don't do well. We're afraid for his safety. So that's how he ends up in Westville. That's where he goes psychotic. That's where he's involuntarily medicated and ultimately mm-hmm. gives the confessions. So it's pretty interesting. It's probably not as bombshelly as the things that you were talking about, which had a lot of people.
This part, we kind of already knew that. Like, people were already.
Right.
Even the people that think he's innocent or guilty either way, like you can't treat people like that prior to trial.
And right. And there's a Supreme Court case called Chronic where, you know, basically it says that this is, they find that that hearing, the safekeeping hearing early on, was a critical stage, then it's basically an automatic redo. But the question is going to be, is the appellate court going to consider that to be a critical stage of the process? And I'm talking about the safekeeping hearing. You know, I mean, you could argue it either way, and ultimately, that could be something that they hang their head on. It's a good argument. It's a strong argument, but that concept of whether or not that is a critical stage of the process is going to be really the thing that kind of is going to determine whether or not that issue will hit the nail on the head in terms of getting a new trial or not. So the second thing they really got into was really interesting. And to me, it was powerful in that it relates to the state's timeline. And it talks about that thing that everybody was talking about, which from the one juror that we have heard from, it sounds like that the van coming upon the killer and the killer being startled by it. And ultimately then that forces the killer's hand to kill the girls almost immediately after seeing the van. And that's mm-hmm. what the state builds their timeline around. You know, that's where you have the time of death at the 2:32, the last time that the phone moved. So they're really locked into that. Like, the state went so far as McClelland during his closing argument said that, you know, both the girl, which was very powerful. I mean, it was a very powerful closing, and he ended it with, you know, the girls were heroes, because Libby had taken the video of the person that they believe was guilty or committed the crimes. And then the second thing was that Abby, in her last act, had hidden the phone underneath her right before she died, so the killer wouldn't know the phone was there. And that was like mic drop type stuff. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, it was really powerful to the jury. So, but that really, really nailed them in terms of their timeline. Like, this is where we are saying this all went down. And part of building that up, and the reason it mattered was because Richard Allen allegedly had made a confession to Monica Wall, the prison psychologist, who noted in the system when she typed up, allegedly, her handwritten notes from her, that particular session with Richard Allen. That's where he had said, oh, well, you know, I had the girls on the bridge, something happened with the gun, I dropped the bullet or something like that. And then, you know, I was heading down and we saw a white van. It spooked me. You know, I was going to sexually assault the girls and then I decided I had to kill them. You know, so that whole thing hinged upon this guy who lived right around the trestle, meaning
right
on a high bridge. And, you know, like off, he was private property on the other side of the trail system. And he has that private road. And that guy's name is Brad Weber. And he was one of the guys that they had testify at trial. He was kind of a bombshell. And he definitely surprised the defense a bit in that he had changed his testimony from what they knew he had said to law enforcement prior, which is he had said to a Hammond cop and a Fed that he had not gone home straight after work, that he had gone and serviced, and he worked at a Subaru plant in Lafayette, Indiana, which from all accounts is about a 25-minute ride from door to door. So, right, you know, like what, which would have, in a perfect world, in the state's perfect world, would have put him driving onto the property right at around 2:30, 2:31 p.m., which lines up perfectly with their theory, right? So, you know, he ends up changing his story where he had said initially that he had gone to service his ATM machines that he had owned and he had in various gas stations and other locations, you know, if they needed to be filled with money or if they needed receipt tape, whatever. You know, he had initially claimed that he had done that day and then he got home and then taken a nap. So he says, no, I didn't do that. I came straight home at trial. He says, I came straight home from work. And so they then, at that point, had somebody that could substantiate the fact that he was home, that he owns a white van, which he testified that he had driven that day, and that he got home right at the time that Richard Allen, in his confession, stated that he saw a white van that spooked him. So it lined up perfectly for them. So you could see how that would be very, very powerful evidence.
Yeah.
Timeline. It really, it's like, oh my God, like he, that is something that only the killer would know at first blush. So what they did is they found, they being the defense team, I know what the question's going to be, which is what the state ends up responding to in this, is they found this video from a house that was further back where that has a timestamp that you can see this white van coming in and driving on that private road. It's way off in the distance, but you can definitely see that it's the white van, this cargo van. And that van doesn't come into frame until 2:44 that day. So like a full 12 minutes after they're claiming, the state's claiming that the girls are already, that the phone's done moving, which in their estimation means that the girls are no longer alive.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so it really, in my estimation, destroys their timeline because he couldn't have seen the van when they said that he saw the van if their time of death is correct in terms of that the phone never moved. So
when they say that it stopped moving, then is that based on where it was hitting towers, or
how
did they establish? What I'm getting at is how they established that, like, that meant like 2:32, that's it, that's they're dead. Like, couldn't they just have been
Apple just health at the data? It was the Apple
health data.
Yep.
So the phone steps. The phone physically wasn't moving, wiggling, correct, anything anymore at that point.
Correct. It was the steps. You know, so right, the steps were. That was kind of a big part of their case, you know, in terms of saying, all right, well, this many steps occurred, and, you know, it's about the same amount of steps it would have been from leading from the bridge down the hill to where, right around where the girls were found, you know, and it was argued by the defense, well, it actually led right down to that private drive where there could have been a car lying in wait and the girls were just ushered into the vehicle. And, you know, the defense had opined, well, we could have, you know, if the phone was in the trunk with the girls, that would have blocked it from working, kind of like a Faraday bag would.
Yeah.
That it would have the same effect, or if, like, when you get in the elevator and you lose your signal and you're not able to connect. So, but, like, the bigger point to me in that argument was the fact that they had this video and it really does destroy the state's timeline. Now, the question in terms of this particular issue being brought up at this juncture is whether or not it's actually newly discovered evidence, because it was certainly in the discovery that they were tendered, you know, so the state had a hold of it, you know, but that also raises the question from the state's perspective, why did McClelland, if he knew about that video, put a witness on and have him testify to a time he knew that he wasn't driving that van? So it's an interesting development, and we'll have to see how it gets ruled on. Like, Gull is going to deny this. There's no question about it. She's certainly not going to grant him a new trial based on this, but kind of how it has an impact on the appellate process is what's going to be interesting about it. So there, that was the second thing.
Before you move on to the third, let me just kind of circle around to that, so make sure I'm understanding it right. So it was in discovery. They did turn it over to the defense. The defense had it the whole time, didn't use it at trial. But then there is the argument that, because I look at the, I always, as you know, in like post conviction work, you always get into the, like, what practically matters and what legally matters. And most of the time, it seems to go the other way, where it's like, well, yeah, I mean, that practically helps us know this person is innocent, but legally there's no argument there. This one almost feels like the opposite, because, like, that 12 minutes, like, I could come up with a million scenarios if she just dropped her phone and then 12 minutes later she was killed, you know, like because she didn't have her phone in her hand, it could have been laying on the ground. But on the legal argument side of it, it would seem to me, and that's kind of what I want to ask you about, is the fact that the state built their narrative that they gave to the jury around this broken timeline, even if there's another explanation, but that other explanation was never presented to the jury, is that something that you think would matter to an appellate judge? I know Gull will deny it, but if an appellate judge sees it.
It could, because of the fact that, I mean, that was their entire theory. You know what I mean? There was no other theory that, oh, well, she dropped it earlier, because their theory, and the phone was found underneath Abby. That's how they came up with that whole concept. So that would have to mean that, but, you know, that still doesn't work for the state's theory, because their concept is that she hid it so that the killer didn't know that they had a phone, which to me is ridiculous. I mean, if Bridge Guy is the killer, then he sees Libby holding the phone as he's approached.
Yeah.
He sees that it exists. Like, it would be implausible to think that whoever did this, whether it's Alan or somebody else, that they weren't aware of the fact that one or both of them had a phone.
Yeah, so, I think a more likely scenario is that it got dropped and then in the panic just didn't think, and she landed on it and, you know, ended up on top of it, and then just they forgot about it and got out of there.
Right, exactly. Or that Libby had handed it off to Abby at some point, you know, during their interaction. But that, you know, either way, that phone, in the state's estimation, stops moving. You know, and there was a lot of argument at trial about what that means. Is there ways that the phone could have, because the defense is pretty convinced that the girls were not there that night at the time that the search went on. You know, that entire area was lit up like a football field. That was, the fire chief had said that in, like, the Down the Hill podcast early on, because when he was on the stand at trial, they couldn't really pin him down as to how well lit it was back there at the time that all the searching was going on the day that the girls went missing, which is the 13th of February. So, you know, but he had said previously, like years prior, that that night that that entire area was like just completely illuminated, like unbelievably illuminated. So, you know, it had always been the defense's theory, like how could that many people have missed the girls? You know, because it's like they certainly weren't covered with the sticks. It's like, right, they were not camouflaged in that type of way. You know, and a bigger point, I think, is if you have a situation, because, you know, you hear the state's argument, well, and they made a point to make sure that first responders and searchers were testifying, though, well, we weren't looking for dead girls. We were looking for missing girls, you know, like how they're huddled up, or, you know what I mean? It was like, so this weird distinction that they tried to make, you know, because like if it's me heading there and I'm a first responder and I heard that they were on the bridge, my first thought would be, oh my God, they fell off, or they fell through, they went down, and I'd be looking in the river. Now, in this case, they found a lot of articles of clothing in the river. So, which means that if that's where they were looking, if they were searching pretty diligently with flashlights and the floodlights, they would have been looking in the river. And I just find it hard to believe that they wouldn't have seen any of these clothes that we're talking about, like small piles of clothes that are pretty visible. You know, I mean, that they were, you know,
did they find any of the clothes that first night?
No, that's what I'm saying.
They didn't find it. Okay. Gotcha.
Like, so like those clothes, when they would have definitely been searching the water very, very heavily in the shores to see if they went in, you know, no one sees any of the clothes. And so that was one of the kind of the bigger point, like bones of contention at trial in terms of, you know, how well lit it was. Cause I was always of the mindset, man, you have to destroy this timeline if you're the defense, because I just find it implausible for that many people to be in that area, in a real concentrated area on both sides of the creek, and that nobody saw anything. You know, it's like that they were there, but no, like everybody missed it.
Well, I have two questions about that. I have not, you know, gotten all of the trial evidence. One, is it confirmed that they were searching in the area? Because I mean, you would think, I mean, it's right there. It wasn't very far away. Like, is it confirmed? Do we know they searched that area? And two, was there a time during the night, you know, for this other theory that if the bodies were moved there, was there a block of time where nobody was out there?
Well, there was a block of time. They basically called off the search at around 2 a.m., at least as far as the official law enforcement first responder search. That shuts down at around 2 in the morning. And I think they're out of the area by 2:30. It's come to be known that other individuals, citizens, were continuing to search down there. So, like that is out there. There's been 911 calls that were made that, you know, exist that indicate that there were people still down there searching after they kind of pulled up stakes that morning. So, in terms of the testimony at trial, the state, as you can imagine, was very careful not to have any of their witnesses say that we were in that quadrant, which would have been north of the creek, which is where the girls were found. You know, like he was kind of like, oh, we came in on the private drive and we were on the south side of the creek, and they were trying to get, you know, well, was anybody on the other side? And he was like, yeah, there were people on the other side. Well, do you know where they were? And he's like, well, you know, they seemed to be closer to us, you know, to the west, as opposed to being in that like northeast quadrant where the girls were actually found. I mean, we're just talking about this. There was hundreds of people out there like that night. You know, there had to have been somebody or multiple.
Well, this part kind of just blows my. I guess I had always assumed that they had never searched that area, only because. But now as we're talking about it, and I'm thinking about it, and I know the map and I know the area. I've been part of these searches on several occasions, as you know, my 16 years as a firefighter.
Right.
Several times we've had where, you know, a kid goes missing in a wooded area, and, you know, we call out. And when you said that they called the search off at two, like we would, I can't imagine them calling it off unless they had grid searched, unless they were sure that all of that wooded area there was completely searched. Like I would never, if we have a, you know, two teenage girls missing in there, just to be like, oh, well, it's two, we're going to call it a day. Like usually the triggering point to call it off is, okay, we've exhausted all of this. We've searched all of this. So let's regroup and come back in the daylight. You don't, because it's already been dark for hours. It's not like it got dark at 2 a.m.
Right.
So I can't imagine what the trigger would be to be like, you know what, we'll search that part tomorrow. That right. I just can't, from, and that's anecdotal, but from my own personal experience, I can't imagine. We'd be out there with thermal imaging cameras. We'd be out there with anything we could find.
Yeah.
I'm shocked they didn't do that. Or maybe they did. You know if they use any thermal imaging?
Well, what I heard is that they had a thermal imaging drone up in the air that was looking for heat sources from up on high. And again, from what I've heard is that they claim that there was no indication there was any body heat coming from anywhere in that area. So, which again, you know, you're still going to, if the girls are killed according to the state's timeline, those bodies are not producing no heat, like even that many hours later, like the body temperature, there's still going to be some kind of body temperature that I think would register on a, you know, on the thermal.
It would. And I could tell you that from, because those types of drones are used a lot in the deer hunting world. Now they've started over the last few years, have gotten popular.
Yeah.
And I've seen tons and tons of video where people will come out where, you know, they shot a deer in the evening. They tracked it all night, couldn't find it in the morning. They couldn't find it. And they call one of these drones out 10, 12 hours later. And it takes them 5 minutes. I mean, they scan, they can find it, because they can, you know, the bodies are still holding enough heat and they can tell this is not a live deer, because they can tell, you know, by the intensity of the light that it's still got some heat, but it's not full in. And it's like they zoom into it, boom, 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 and they put a GPS pin on it immediately. So that, yeah, this is something, I know I'm rambling a little bit, but I've never considered the idea of the fact that it's possible that the bodies, that always seems, on a practical level, that always seems way too out there conspiracy theory to me in most cases like this, because people don't spend time like that with bodies. They don't take risks like that. They don't go, you know, but the fact that it's never really occurred to me that all that searching happened and then they had a thermal imaging drone and didn't pick up anything. Certainly any time between 2:30 and, you know, in that 12-hour period, like, I don't know when the drones went up, but they would have definitely found, that's what they're used for. Like
right
now, like primarily now, because yeah, they're used for law enforcement. That's a rare occasion, but people use them to find dead deer all the time.
Yeah.
That's exactly what people use them for.
Yeah. And
if you guys want to, for any of you listening, if you want to get an example of how these work, just go on YouTube and look up thermal image deer recovery and watch these things work. It's fascinating how it works. And then tell me that they couldn't tell that there was a dead body in there.
Right. And it was a real interesting fact that portion of the search didn't come up at trial at all by either side. You know, if I'm the defense and I have confirmation that took place, like, why wouldn't they have brought that on? It's like, right, that's pretty compelling evidence that the girls were moved, you know, that would,
is really, there confirmation that it happened?
I have heard from a cop that worked with Carroll County that it absolutely happened. They had a thermal drone up there, thermal imaging drone up there.
If any of the, now that the trial's over, or have any of the, because that, like, that's something for me, I would want to, you know, I would be FOIA in that police report and I'd be looking for the deed, because that would be obviously documented.
Yeah. No, they're not. Yeah. For, like, I've sent out a FOIA request. They're all, which it's not surprising that I was denied. But, like, I mean, people have been sending FOIA requests in since the day that the thing ended. It's getting denied. Like, McClellan, the prosecutor, is the one sending, like, the, hey, you know, we still are not going to share this. We consider it to be an active investigation, which is
just fucking adjudicated. How are they? Like, what?
I don't know, man. You're like, it's, there's still that concept that even though they think that he's, you know, they're saying out of one side of their mouth, they think he's the only guy, you know, they still, like, even after the arrest, if you go back to all the press conferences, you're hearing them saying, oh, well, we're keeping the tip line open, you know, after Allen's arrested, because they've always kind of thought that it was multiple people that did this just because of the nature of the crime scene. So it's, you know, it's one of those cases, man, that is just a real, real head scratcher, you know. It's like I said, like I can't really think of any cases. And, you know, I've been an attorney for a long time and I've followed, you know, cases all over the country for a long time. I can't think of a case where it's more kind of widely disputed whether or not they have the right person than this case, like right after the trial. And you've like, I've just never seen a situation where law enforcement's out there trying to basically sell the public on the fact that they got the right person. Still, you know, they're all doing like the media tour, which is just, it like, it's not like an individual in a documentary, you know, kind of patting themselves on the back, which you typically see in these kind of docs, like how they solve the crime. You know, this is like them trying to convince, you know, blame YouTubers, blame people like me that are out there like, hey, keep your eyes open, you know, use your mind, use some common sense, these types of things. You know, just because the state has proposed a theory doesn't mean that it's right. You know, it's like the same thing that I'm always trying to like drill into people's heads. I'm like, prosecutors weren't there. The cops weren't there. The defense wasn't there. None of them know what happened. Quit using right. it in the definitive. Like, you know what happened. You don't know what happened. You weren't there. You have a theory right. as to what happened. So
I've yapped us on. Usually, I'm trying to hone you in. Now I'm running us all over the place.
I got you all excited with the thermal imaging.
Yeah,
like as soon as I get you on deer hunting, dude, you're off to the races.
Right. But that's the first two. So what was the third one?
So the third thing is the thing that you were talking about. So they have this confession, jailhouse confession from this guy named Ron Logan. Now, if you know anything about the case, Ron Logan is whose property that the girls were found on. Ron Logan was a suspect very, very early on. And, you know, he had lied about an alibi in terms of where he was and what time he was, you know, at home and when he was at this fish store and again in Lafayette, which is again that 25 minute drive. So turns out that he was in the county on a probation violation. And I don't know if he was in county or I want to see if he was in DOC or if he was in county jail. So he was at the Newcastle Correctional Facility. So he was in DOC. So he allegedly makes this confession to this guy, another inmate named Reese, and that's R-I-C-C-I. Okay. And this Reese Davis says, and I thought it was Ricky, but it's Reese. So he says, and I want to kind of read through what they translated to, because he writes this written confession. This is back in like right after the crimes took place, you know, back in like 2017, like June.
Way before anybody was on Richard Allen.
Way before. This is June of 2017. So a few months after the murders take place. And this is, they have the handwritten statement from him saying that Ron Logan had confessed to him in there. And he says that these are kind of the points. He says that Ron said something that he was walking and talking about knowing one of their dads. So this is him up on the bridge saying that he sees the girls up on the bridge. And he says, oh, you know, I know one of your dads. And that, you know, he said he wanted to walk with them. And he says that one of them wanted to turn around. He says, then he grabbed the youngest's shoulder and he says, you know, he's telling her it's okay. And that the older one freaks out. And then one said something about calling the police. And he said that, you know, the sexual attack wasn't true. He said, I wasn't originally not trying to go rape them. He said he was paranoid about his probation, that if, you know, the girls went to the police and said something to, you know, law enforcement about this old creep was, you know, grab my friend, you know, they'd revoke his probation. So he said he felt like he had crossed the line when he grabbed the youngest one. Okay. And that's the first page. So then he continues on and it's this guy, this Reese Davis guy writing this shit. He says that he started talking and he said that it was ironic because they should have been in school. The girls should have been, which they should have been that day. And that he knew that one of their moms had waitressed at a bar and says something about animals and he walked with them and he was willing to ask them if he wanted to go check out the horses. And he said that he told them that he had rabbits in a barn And so they walked through the trails in the woods. And again, the oldest was paranoid and she didn't want to go. And that the youngest, and I'm assuming, even though they're around the same age, like he would have no reason to know that, but I'm assuming that, you know, Abby looked more mature, or Abby looked less mature than Libby did. So he would have considered Abby to be the younger, which she was. But like for him to know, like I think in his mind, it would have been Abby was the one that was the younger.
She just looked younger.
She did. So he says she wanted to go see the horses. He said that when he grabbed the shoulder, that the oldest turned to help the younger. And the oldest started, and they couldn't make out what it was. They have either looking or kicking. And this is coming straight from the pleading. And it says the youngest, again, couldn't see. They couldn't make out what the word was. And I have the actual note. They included it in the filing. So he says, the youngest, unintelligible, says he grabs the oldest. He says he got hit on the nose and he was scared that he got blood on one of the girls. So he's claiming one of the girls popped him in the nose enough so that he started bleeding. And then he says he pulled out a box cutter and slit the oldest one and hit an artery. The youngest one, he says, is terrified. So he took the little girl with him for a while and never said where. And then he said he cut her to both necks. So like, I think he meant on both sides of the neck. And then it continues on. He said that he left again and came back later in the evening and the search was going on. He said later, around late hours, he tried to move the oldest one to an area so they were not going to be found, a place where four-wheelers go. And then he said he burned his clothes in a burn pile. And then there's something about hiking, boots, gloves, and a bag. And then he says, seems to say that the sole of his boots might still be in the burn pile, that he was worried about that. The next morning, two other girls knocked on the door and asked to search the property, said he felt weird if he would say no. And he let them take off and look. And then he got a hold of a family member and got out of the area. So, and it continues on. He says it's the first time that he had seen them from his property. Because the guy, like, just kept saying all this kind of shit. Ron Logan kept continually talking about this. So it seems like this wasn't all in one session. And, you know, that he was home and he's got guns and et cetera. And that during the struggle with the youngest girl, and it's tough to read. He says not, like there's the word not. And I can see where they can't see. It says during the struggle, the youngest girl, I think it says screamed. That's what it sounds like to me. It's really tough to make out though, because it's kind of chicken scratch. And he said he happened by a friend to stand there and then head, neck, artery. And so he ends it by saying that, you know, he's like, I am not looking for anything, because you and I both know that that's always the biggest kind of rub with in custody or jailhouse snitches. They're always looking for time off, right? You know, they're looking for something in return. This guy made a point to write that, you know, I'm not looking for anything in return here. It's like, I'm in here for 50 years. Like I'm done. He's like, I just want justice for the girls. So again, this was in the discovery, you know, this like pretty compelling confession, especially now that the state has moved their concept that Rick Allen used a box cutter, you know, to commit the crime. Right. Like that was their thing at trial. And you know, I mean,
well, I think it's important to point out the thing that grabbed me is in 2017, 2018, as far as I know, no one knew that their throats were slit. Like no one knew that.
Right.
I mean, I've talked to Kelsey back then and she didn't, at least she didn't let on to me that she knew the exact cause of death.
No one did unless they were leaked the information. Like it certainly wasn't out to the public, you know, like some guy
in prison certainly didn't know that.
Yeah. I mean, if you were to look on Reddit probably back then, you know, I think that there was a lot of chatter that it was kind of somebody had let slip that that was kind of how the nature of the MO was, that the girls had been killed with a, you know, they had been like a sharp object. But like, I mean, like as far as anybody able to prove it at that point, it was all speculation. You know, it was like the same thing.
And again, it's like, how long had this guy been in prison?
It predated this. Like he wouldn't have been in
Reddit. He's not on Reddit is what I'm getting at. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah. Like how the fuck would he know that?
Right. Exactly. And like Ron's like an old man and, you know, and Ron Logan, you know, if you talk to his ex Connie, you know, like as soon as she saw the video and heard the voice, she's like, oh my God, he's finally done it. Like she, without question, still like today thinks that Ron did this. You know, she's like,
Ron deceased?
Yes, he died.
Yeah.
He died. He's been dead. You know, mm-hmm. It's like, to me, like with that thing in their possession, and it's just got a lot of facts that seem to fit. And it makes sense. You know, because when you talk about, it doesn't really make sense that somebody would move the bodies and then decide to bring them back if it required them to like put them in a vehicle, drive away from the trails, go home,
yeah,
do whatever with them, and then
yeah, you don't drive them back
and then drive them back to the same place where you snatched them. Seems crazy, right? It doesn't really. It seems unlikely. Makes a lot more sense when that dude has outbuildings on his property and easily could have hidden the girls and is out in one of his outbuildings,
right,
while the search is going, you know, going down, and then when it quiets down, he brings them back out there, whether alive or dead at that point, you know, but you know, we don't see any kind of ligature marks. So in terms right. of like, how would he be controlling them? So, you know, it's interesting. So that thing's in there, man, you know, and it's going to go to the weight again of their third party culprit defense being denied. Now, you know, the state's going to argue that defense again didn't bring this up, didn't mention this prior to trial in their in the 3 days of motions that they had trying to get the third party culprit stuff in. They mentioned Ron Logan. He was somebody on their list, along with mm-hmm. Kagan Klein, and you know, but they had really gone into a very detailed testimony and kind of narrative about Kagan Klein at that 3 days of hearings, whereas they just mentioned Ron Logan, didn't get into mm-hmm. any of this. So it begs the question as to why, you know, because you had a similar situation with Kagan Klein where he basically threw his father under the bus, saying that they had been out there that day, you know, because he's the guy with the Tony Schatz or the Anthony Schatz account that,
right,
you know, is the thing that was thought to have drawn the girls up to the bridge that day. You know, it was that catfish account, and he was the one that was running it, he being Kagan Klein. And, you know, at some point he claims that him and his father are in their red vehicle, like a red Jeep out there, like down on that private drive, and that his father gets out of the truck for like 2 hours, comes back, he's bloody, that they drive over the Wabash Bridge and throw a knife and a cell phone into it, which law enforcement actually dragged the river, you know? Mm. So it's,
I remember when they drug the river. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's like, so they really kind of went into depth on that and then just skipped over this whole Ron Logan thing. Like again, like they had 15 terabytes. I mean, is it possible they didn't discover this? And they, you know, they went on a speedy, you know, it's like, yeah, that's a hell of a lot of evidence that doesn't come to them organized, and they were kicked off the case and brought back on, which meant they had to turn over the discovery and then get it all back and had to reorganize right. it, you know? So, I mean,
plus theory, it sounds like this was not easy to read, that it was a handwritten,
right, if, difficult for sure,
to read.
For sure. You know, it's definitely scribbling, but again, you know, it's like, you've got the state knowing this exists, you know, I mean, in theory, you can't argue Brady because it turned it over. Right. It was in the discovery. So it's definitely yeah. not like a Brady argument. So, but it's interesting to say the least.
It's weird because all the layers they get labeled, you know, because you look at it like, was it Brady or it's ineffective? But there was, then also you have the judge wouldn't let any third party coming in. And then they didn't argue it effectively at that point. Cause I mean, that's because I, you know, as I said, earlier than you touched on, you know, it seems conspiratorial to think that someone would move the bodies back. But as you're saying, the two things that jumped out to me, one, yeah, if they were killed on that property, then yeah, so that's actually getting them further away. And the other thing is just behaviorally speaking, you know, when do people move bodies? They move bodies when the bodies are in a location that would tie them to the crime. That's when people will take the risk. So like if the bodies were in his outbuilding, for example, or right, something like that, then yeah, then you take the risk. Then you move them because you know if they're found in your house, you're in trouble.
You're yeah, done.
So you got right. so all of a sudden it doesn't seem so conspiratorial anymore.
Right, exactly. And you know, he probably has a pretty good understanding. And he was his reason, stated reason for making up the alibi that his cousin drove him to the fish store so that he had somebody to corroborate it, was that he said that he was driving was a no-no, that would have been a violation of his probation. So that was why he lied about his cousin. Not that
I didn't even know that he lied about his alibi too.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's like, they really haven't been able to nail down when he went to this fish store in Lafayette. So, cause it could have been, you know, if he killed the girls closer to the time that the state thinks, like around that 2:30 time window, you know, that could have been where he's got the girls in the one of the outbuildings. You know, he's like, oh shit, man. I got to go do something. You know, I got to get on the grid somehow. Yeah. So, you know, cause he apparently went to this fish store and bought, you know, a bunch of saltwater fish. And, you know, it's like one of those things where you're kind of like, if you're a cop, you're going over there inquiring as to, you know, well, how many did he buy? And, you know, was there anything memorable about what he was doing? You know, cause if you're trying to create an alibi, you want to do something that would make you memorable to other people to be able to substantiate that you were there. Short of them having like video in the store, you know, where you're just like relying on somebody's memory. You know, so that's an interesting aspect of it. But if he had killed the girls, it's like, all right, I got to establish an alibi that I was like in Lafayette, like in and around the time that this might have happened, with kind of like leaning on the fact that nobody's going to know exactly when it happened.
Yeah.
You know, it kind of fits like pretty well, actually. So, so that was the Ron Logan thing.
Well, so I had heard, it was on my local news the other day, actually. I heard that the prosecutor had responded to that and said that, is it Rich? What was the guy's name that wrote the letter?
Reese Davis.
Reese. That he had, that the reason that they didn't find it credible was because he failed a polygraph. Do you know anything about that?
I mean, other than he failed a polygraph, no.
That's it.
Yeah. But it's like, I think Ron Logan failed a polygraph too. So, I mean, it's like, but when you sit here and kind of think, like, why, if this guy's not looking for something, like, what, like, where's the angle? Like, give me the angle. Is the angle, oh, he was full of shit. He really was looking for something. He was just saying he wasn't looking for something. Is that the angle? Like, why would this guy make this shit up?
Yeah. Well, even my thing is, even if he was looking for something, I don't doubt that. I mean, they do that all the time, right? I'm not looking for anything, but when they really are. But still, like, there's guilty knowledge in that. And did he know Logan before meeting him in prison?
Nope.
It's like, how the fuck would he even know that it was his property?
Right.
Random guy in the prison. You know, right. So there's obviously some conversation. There had to been.
Yeah, there, like, clearly, you know, and I mean, this is in, like, what we don't get in this particular filing is, you know, like, Newcastle isn't in Delphi. You know, I don't know where Davis lives. Like, I don't know if he's privy to kind of the facts of the case at all. Like, I don't know if Reese Davis is sitting around prison and reading the paper, you know, like I right. don't know any of those things because they didn't really kind of get into it in terms of like what his potential knowledge base of the case could be, to where, cause this guy seemed to know a lot of facts, you know, like the bridge and that there's two girls and, you know, all these different things that seem to exist that would indicate that he certainly had a conversation with Logan. you know?
Yeah. Is Reese still alive and around, like available to be deposed?
I have not been able to get like a confirmed answer of that question. I heard that he is still alive, and then I've heard that he's not. So I think that he is, but you know, don't quote me on it. I don't know for certain whether he's alive or not.
Okay, well, that one's certainly bombshelly. What was the fourth element?
So the last one was Stacey Eldridge, who was their she was their cell phone tech expert, who was really who came up with what I consider to be another just kind of earth shattering like timeline destroyer, because she's the one who came up with the fact that there was something was plugged into the headphone jack, you know, for him from 5:44 p.m. on the 13th, and it was unplugged at 10:32 p.m. the same day, so on the 13th. So for almost a 5-hour period, something was plugged into that port. That's where you have the whole thing where the state's expert went down on the break in the middle of trial and went and Googled and said, oh, well, you know, I Googled it during the break, and it sounds like if you get water or dirt in that port, that it can, you know, give you a false positive that something was plugged in there. So they wanted to kind of follow up on that. And basically what it says is that Stacey Eldridge provided an affidavit and states that dirt or water damage to the phone could not have caused the auxiliary jack on LG's phone to log wired headphone plugged in and wired headphones unplugged. Miss Eldridge's expert opinion is newly discovered evidence that would probably produce a different result at a new trial. I mean, because essentially, like after Cecil had done that, I'm like, well, like, what do they do? Do they call her, recall her the following day? Because she was at the very end of the state's case or the defense's case in chief. So like strategically, I'm like, well, what are they going to do? Are they going to have her come back? But that also allows for the state, because they still had their rebuttal case coming. So, you know, strategically you're thinking, okay, they've already had Cecil get on the stand with this whole fucking Google thing. And, you know, and O'Shea did a nice job, like destroying him on the stand. He's like, this is how you do your police investigation. We're 7 years in. And you never looked to see if there was water damage on the phone. You know, you never looked, you've had the same information from the Cellebrite, you know, extraction report that this was indicated in there. Like, this isn't something that we found that you didn't find. You did find it. You just don't know what it meant. Like, and you told us in your deposition that you didn't know what that meant. Like, why didn't you fucking Google that, dude? Like, what does this mean? You know,
just to give you a little update while you were talking here, Reese Davis Jr. is still alive and is still housed at the Newcastle Correctional Facility.
Good update.
Earliest possible release date is June 15th, 2039.
Ooh.
So he's still available.
I should go talk to that dude.
Yeah, I would. I want to.
Yeah.
This case is like that's
I know.
Nobody needs to.
I know. I got to get on his list. Yeah. All right, good. That was good digging, dude. All right. So that's essentially what she says. So they basically argue that if she had the time, you know, in terms of being able to kind of research that issue, that she would have been able to provide that expert opinion that the wired headphones were plugged in at 5:44 and that they're unplugged at, you know, whatever, 10:23. And, you know, there's no way what the state is claiming happened could have happened. So it's her opinion that dirt or water could not have caused LG's phone to log wired
headphones. So that's something the Gull is going to for sure just deny this whole thing.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, like I'm surprised then, she hasn't already.
And then that evidence won't be able to be used in the direct appeal either, right? Because it's not new, or because it's new evidence.
Well,
so they have to wait until after direct.
It depends, right? I mean, worst case scenario is going to have to come in after direct. I mean, it's part of the record, so I mean, they might be able to consider the issues of, because that's why I'm saying it's a motion to correct errors of the trial. So, like, it can be taken into consideration, and I think it's kind of one of those things, like, where you can't unring a bell.
Yeah.
That the defense is hoping that they'll read through it, You know, especially with the third-party culprit stuff of Ron Logan. Like, they situated kind of right in the middle, and it's pretty compelling. You know, it's like if they think that Allen's confessions are compelling after the conditions that he was in, you know, whatever he says, which is mostly like, I did it. Yeah, okay, I did it. Killed a girl. You know, you're not getting any of those kind of detailed confessions other than the one that Walla claims that he stated. So this one, I mean, to you, does it create a nexus? I mean, you can't make the argument, which was what Gull kept saying. You haven't provided me anything that puts any of those guys at the bridge that day. Like, that was where that was her sticking point. Like, you don't have that problem with the Ron Logan thing. You know, you just don't. I mean, it's his property the girls were found on. So, and now you've got him confessing to it, allegedly. You know, it's like, so
it's going to be such a legal tangle because of the, because I could see this, the attorneys falling on their sword and agreeing that it was ineffective assistance of counsel, but God, there's so many more layers to it because you still have that plays into whether third party should have been allowed. And so can they claim, as you being an attorney, you know, I know Indiana is a little different than Illinois, but can they file ineffective assistance of counsel based on pretrial stuff, like the fact that he didn't argue this Logan confession in that pretrial hearing?
It's pretty rare. It's pretty rare to dip into ineffective on direct. I mean, it's not to say that it can't be done. You know, the problem in that particular situation is that, like, all three of them really want to retry the case. Like, they want to be the lawyers to retry it. You know, and they'll be the first to admit, you know, that there's shit that they missed. There's things that they wish they would have done, you know, but like, I have zero doubt if it came down to it, if it would help their client, that they'd lie on the sword in a heartbeat, you know? I mean, like, so, but like, that's not going to be the thing that gets them a retrial. You know, it's not going to get remanded on ineffective at this juncture in terms of what should have been introduced or what could have been introduced and wasn't. You know, it's going to have, it'll be the bigger, broader arguments that are made that, like, Gull really did deny them putting any kind of defense on, which she did. You know, I think that's going to be a big deal to the appellate court, you know, and however they're going to treat the confessions and how they were extracted from Allen during that time of confinement. You know, I think that it could be a totality of the circumstances type situation, which will move the needle away from harmless error, if it does at all, at the direct appeal level. And, you know, like, from a lot of the lawyers that I've talked to that handle appeals out in Indiana, they're not real confident about the appellate court, but they feel like it might have better success up at the Supreme Court of Indiana level, especially with respect to the confession side of it, and just that those were involuntary due to the confinement conditions. So, you know, but look, it's far from over, man. It's like I keep trying to tell people that, like, this is one of those cases that, and you've just got adamant people on both sides of it. But, like, really, the people on the you know, that Allen's trial was not fair are very adamant. You know, this guy just did not get a fair trial. And again, we all want to feel secure in convictions as much as we can. You know, it's never going to be perfect. There is no such thing as a perfect trial. But, you know, you've got to, in order to kind of get people to move the needle for the people that don't think that he did it and that they didn't have any evidence really showing that he did, other than his own statement that he was there and this unspent casing thing, you know, they're going to have to allow for an actual fair trial to take place where they can put it all out there. You know, because, I mean, the state's evidence is never going to change.
Right.
You know, their case, I don't think, can get any better than it was, you know, and I didn't think it was a great case to begin with. I mean, that was always my thing. I'm like, man, like, when that PCA dropped, I'm like, how are they going to trial on this? Like, they have to be hoping for more. Like, and I think if you were to have an honest conversation with any of these cops or the prosecutor, that they all were under the belief that they would find that smoking gun evidence probably on Allen's devices somewhere.
Right.
You know, and it people make that argument empty. About the, like, well, he conveniently lost that phone. I mean, everything goes up into the cloud, you know, like, things are recoverable even if you don't have the actual physical phone. Like you can, mm-hmm. you can check like his billing from the month in question without having the physical phone to see if he was using the phone at that time, to see if data was being used at that time. You know what I mean?
There's, right.
there were ways to check into that, which neither side again handled. Like it was not dealt with. Like it was the first case where really you don't hear anything about what Richard Allen did that entire day, other than from one of the interrogations wherein he's talking about he was at his mother's house that morning. You know what I'm saying? Like the,
yeah.
the rest of it is all like you have no clue what this guy did that day, where he was that night. Like, you know, it was always one of my biggest things as I was sitting there watching the trial was one of the things I was critical about. I'm like, man, I think I really would have called Kathy, you know, his wife, to the stand.
Yeah.
I think it was important for the jury to hear, you know, that he was home. Like when she got home from work, he was asleep on the couch with the TV on, you know, it's just like, which is true. That's where he was. Like, and Kathy is, you know, she's feisty, which I think is one of the things they were concerned about in terms of putting her on, like if they would have been able to get her riled up. But I don't see how that hurts in that situation.
Yeah.
You know, because it's like you're going to have the people that are going to think, well, you know, it's his wife. She's going to fucking lie, you know,
right.
for him. But, you know, me having spent a lot of time with Kathy Allen, she's a straight shooter. Like if there was any part of her that thought that her husband did this, Kathy wouldn't be backing him anymore. Like she would not, you know, and she's absolutely convinced that her husband didn't do it. You know, she's like, I've known this guy since, you know, we've been married 35 years. Like we were kids when we got married. I know him better than anybody on the planet. You know, and you're like, we know about these guys that go under the radar and then always have these dark secrets and they're doing their fucking weird shit and hiding them, you know, like surreptitiously, like searching for creepy shit on the internet and, you know, their porn stashes and all the shit that leads up to a crime like this, especially if the state's alleging that it was sexual in nature, which they are, you know,
yeah.
I mean, like they leaned into that this is going to be a sexual assault, double sexual assault. And it turned into a murder because he saw the van, you know? So it's like, you just to go from like, oh yeah, you know what? I'm at my mom's having breakfast, hanging with my parents. My sister comes over. I decide to go kill a couple girls at the trail. Crime of opportunity, you know, like I'm just going to go out there, lie in wait, murder two girls when I'm 48. I'm going to break my cherry when I'm 48 years old out in a trail system in the town that I live in. And, you know, I'm going to continue to work in the town. It's hard for me to really kind of wrap my mind around their concept of it, but.
Well, the sad part, I'm going to wrap this thing up, but you know, the sad part about it is, I think about, you know, like I've gotten to know Kelsey over the years and like the family, like this is the fact that we're still having, I almost feel bad having the conversations, but it's like, it needs to be had. Cause it just doesn't, something's amiss here. I'm not saying, you know, for everybody I'm sure comes at me saying that I'm saying, I don't know if he's innocent or guilty, but something's amiss here.
No clue.
And, you know, when you and I, when we were out in the Berkshires, when we went out and chatted a little bit, you know, I told you that, so I remember walking back to the car. At that point, I was like, the thing is, if not him, then who? Nothing makes sense. After this conversation, this is the first time that I've been like, because even with everything we knew leading up to this, I'm like, yeah, the confessions might have been bullshit and all this might have been, but that's still, you haven't shown me any evidence that anybody else did it. Now, for the first time, I'm like, well, now I can see a scenario in my mind that doesn't feel conspiratorial and out there and crazy, where someone else could have done it. And it's just unfortunate that, you know, we don't know if Abby and Libby really got justice. We don't know her family. You know, I hope they're doing okay with all this. And, you know, I don't know. It's just tough. But Bob, I do very much appreciate it. I know you had a busy day traveling, all the stuff going on, taking the time to chat with us again. I'm sure it won't be the last time. I'll probably be hitting you up next week for something again.
I'm right here for you, buddy. You know that.
All right, Bob, I'm going to go ahead and wrap this thing up. Thanks for joining us. And guys, this week on the follow-up, I'm sure it'll be a hot one. We'll be recording on Tuesday night. You guys.
See ya.
Truth and Justice is an NBI Studios production, co-written and produced by Erica Bergenham. Music for Season 15 is created and composed by Caden Ladislaw. Follow-up episodes are co-hosted by Janet Varney and Zach Weaver. Our logo font was created by Tate Krupa of Red Swan Graphic Design. Our website is created, managed, and maintained by Katie Ross of createdintandem.com. Thank you to our volunteer transcription team, Erica Cantor, Kathy McElhaney, Courtney Wimberly, Kaywood Yomnick, Danielle Rohr, Jennifer Athey, and Caroline Dwyer. Truth and Justice provides all investigative and advocacy work for the wrongfully convicted completely free of charge. We're able to do that in large part thanks to you, our listeners, through your generous pledges on Patreon. Patreon accounts for the overwhelming majority of our funding. The number one way you can support our work is to become a patron at patreon.com/truthandjustice. For just $5 a month, you'll get all episodes ad-free, a bonus pregame episode every Wednesday, and also a video version of the Friday follow-ups exclusive to our patrons. Patrons also get to participate and join the chat live in many of our interviews and get early access to much of our content. Just go to patreon.com/truthandjustice to sign up. You can also help us out by going to iTunes and leaving us a 5-star rating and review. It doesn't cost you a penny and goes a long way towards making the show more visible. If you have a new case that you'd like us to consider, you can submit your cases on our website, truthandjusticepod.com. Just click on the case submission button and fill out the form. You can always keep in touch with us through our email at theories@truthandjusticepod.com. You can like our Facebook page or join in on the conversation on the official Truth and Justice Podcast fans page. You can also connect with us on social media platform X at Truth Justice Pod. And to follow our personal accounts on social media, I can be found at Bob Ruff Truth. Janet can be found at Janet Varney, and Zach is at Z to the Q. However you do it, stay engaged and stay in touch. But as for now, we're signing off. I'm Bob Ruff.
I'm Zach Weaver.
And I'm Janet Varney.
And this has been Truth and Justice.